In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Yeah.
To
get Let's talk movies. Pass the Popcorn. Alan Adams from The Main Edge. Joining us here in studio. Happy Monday, Mr. Adams.
And to you as well, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. How was your weekend?
It was pretty good. Pretty good. You know, relatively uneventful, other than, you know, all the movie going. Although we did go out and track down some things. The plan, the hope, is I'm trying to... I've got a little free library.
Oh, nice.
And we're the hope is that I can get that sort of set up and properly installed in the ground before the snow flies. So I'm gonna be so we went out and got some quickcrete and you know got a new shovel because I had snapped the handle of the last one due to my my great might. So I need to get a new one of those and hopefully we'll be able to get that stuff at least the goal is at least get the hole dug and get some stuff started because otherwise I'm just gonna sit on my couch and in front of my heat pump and and watch Hulu and that's no way to live a life, Rich.
It's not so bad.
I mean, my wife is listening, so I need to make sure.
You want to do. You would like to do much more than that. Yeah.
But no, I'm very stoked. I've wanted to have a little free library for a very long time, and it's time for me to make it happen. So
nice.
I think that's, and it sounds like tomorrow's going to be a great day for it.
Oh yeah,
so
absolutely.
If I'm going to be out there digging a hole, at least I get to do it when it's not freezing outside.
And you brought us more goodies today. Carrot cake jam.
Yeah, it's really delicious. It's got a nice little spicy, like nutmeggy sort of cinnamony kind of kick to it. Mm. There's pears involved somehow. Like I don't, yeah. Sharon,
oh
just,
my goodness.
Sharon just goes in and
it smells so good.
She's like a GD wizard. I don't I don't really understand what happens when she's in the kitchen. I just know that when all is said and done, something delicious happens. Mm. I don't need to know any more than that.
No. Just know enough to bring it to your friends.
That's right.
We appreciate that.
Nice to share.
All right. Four movies. Well, let's get to them. You saw Eternals, The French Dispatch, Finch, and The Harder They Fall. Where do you want to begin?
Let's work our way backwards. The Harder They Fall, it's a Netflix original. It's the feature debut of a person by the name of James Samuel. Who also co-wrote the screenplay, and it's a Western, and I'm a big fan of I feel like we're seeing sort of a return to that sort of genre fare. Like we're getting some, we're getting more into that sort of Western territory, both in terms of movies and television, which is great. What this movie does, it also embraces the sort of vibe of the 70s sort of exploitation genre. And so you've got this sort of mashup of like, you know, Sergio Leone and Gordon Parks happening. That's really quite fun. The aesthetic is right. Like they have that sort of wonderfully kind of stylized, kind of dated, graphical look. And it's, it's an all black cast set in the Wild West. And they're very clear about this right up front. The events in this movie may not have happened as they are portrayed. The people being portrayed 100% existed. Like these are real people, like real historical figures dropped into sort of ahistorical circumstances, which I think is a lot of fun. But the basic gist is a young boy sees his family, his mother and father brutally killed before his eyes. He grows up seeking revenge. He grows up to be the noted outlaw Nat Love, played by Jonathan Majors, who has devoted his life to seeking vengeance on those who hurt his family so many years ago. He's assembled a gang, with names that may ring familiar to folks who are familiar with the era. Bill Pickett is one. So he has his gang, and he's in search of... the one known as Rufus Buck, Rufus Buck, played by Idris Elba, who is awesome, and his gang, including Trudy Smith, played by Regina King, the quick draw artist Cherokee Bill, played by Lakeith Stanfield. Like I said, it's just a stacked cast. And it's basically, and that's basically where we go. We have on the one side, we have the Nat Love gang. They're not bank robbers, but they'll rob the people who rob the banks. when they inadvertently hit a group that was bringing their haul to Rufus Buck, that's when the clash really starts to escalate. Meanwhile, there's a marshal floating around, played by Delroy Lindo, who is awesome, as he always is. And then we go full on wildly violent Western. There's a lot of bloodshed, a lot of gunplay, some fist fights, some knifings. It's just a very solid sort of Western adventure. And again, I'll concede it doesn't. When I say Sergi Leone meets Gordon Parks, like, you might have an idea in your head of what that's going to look like. You have to bear in mind this is Netflix, and so a lot of, you know, some of the sharper edges, let's say, are sanded down a little bit.
Yeah.
As far just for the Netflix demographic, but it's really well made. Like I said, the cast is phenomenal. The performances are wonderful. Man, don't I love Idris Elba as a bad guy? There's just something so, like, he just exudes menace in a way that just that very few performers can really do with such effortlessness. Because that's the combination. It's like you're malevolent, but it's really easy for you. Like when you can project that kind of vibe, like, you get something really good. But I mean, everybody. Regina King is great. I love Lakeith Stanfield. Jonathan Majors. Zazie Beetz is in this. A wonderful sort of collection of talent coming together to tell a story of a fictional story of real people. People are either based directly on or inspired by these figures from that era of American history. Don't teach it in history class, but it's if nothing else, it might send you down a rabbit hole. Like, there were definitely a couple of names on here that rang vaguely familiar, and so when I investigated further, I was like, oh, right. And so you kind of wind up in that sort of situation, which is always cool. And even if that's not your thing, it's still a pretty darn good movie.
Excellent. All right. Up next, Tom Hanks, A Dog and a Robot.
Yeah, a man, his dog, and his robot. Finch. Streaming exclusively on Apple TV Plus. Second movie in a row for Hanks, I think, that has done that. Because the World War II movie Greyhound that he did last year was also an Apple TV Plus joint. Look, I love Tom Hanks. He's a cinematic treasure. I am here for whatever Tom Hanks wants to do. I was curious about this one. I mean, the instant point of comparison for me was going to be Castaway. He's playing, instead of a deserted island, he's in a, underground laboratory and after the apocalypse, and he's not talking to himself, he's talking to a robot, but generally, like, that same sort of, the ability to sort of hold one's attention, to hold an audience's attention just with you, with your presence, is an incredible skill to have, and it's a skill that very, very, very few have ever been able to convey on screen, especially. But he clearly can do it. It's a fun's not the right word, but it's a really engaging sort of sci-fi romp. The basic gist, it's been 10 years since a solar flare has essentially ripped apart the ozone layer. That's led to a drastic increase in global temperatures. Daytime temps reach as high as 150 degrees, leaving aside the fact that there's no filter for UV radiation, so exposed skin begins to, be affected in a matter of seconds. And so he's been sort of, his name's Finch, and he's a roboticist, and he has been living in sort of the underground lab in St. Louis of his employer. He has, like, protective gear that he wears to go out and sort of try to salvage whatever he can from the grocery stores and stuff like that, as well as a little rover bot he calls Dewey that sort of assists him on these adventures. He goes back home. He's searching for food for himself, yes, but also for his dog Goodyear, whose story is revealed in the course of the movie. So I won't spoil that now. Just be aware that that Goodyear is clearly a very good dog. But Finch has decided that he needs more, and so he has been working on a much more sophisticated humanoid robot. That he is going to endow with various knowledges into, and keep him around. And initially you're like, oh, he wants someone as a companion. But no. Finch's entire motivation for building this robot is because he's sick, and he wants to make sure there's someone there to take care of the dog.
Oh.
Right? Like, I was wow. just like, you know, it's like that they drop that and I'm like, oh, okay, so you're gonna play with my emotions now, are you, Finch? And the answer is yes. Yes, yes, it is. But he builds the robot. The robot sort of comes to life, voiced by Caleb Landry Jones. When circumstances reveal that a massive superstorm is coming that will leave them trapped underground for a biblical length of time, 40 days, they decide to they got to get out of there. And so they hit the road in a modified RV. Finch, the robot, who ultimately decides that his name is Jeff. And Goodyear the dog. And then we're off. And then there's a stretch where it's like, it's almost like a road comedy, like a buddy comedy kind of thing that's happening, like a sort of, odd couple-y, opposites attract kind of situation. All set against the incredibly bleak, sand-covered black backdrop of a post-apocalyptic world. But we undertake the journey, and they make their way west because that's the one place that they've determined might be safe, and so that's where they're headed. And we'll leave the synopsizing at that. I think that's a good spot to put it. But yeah, it's a surprisingly engaging movie. It's well made. Hanks is great, like he always is. Like, he's got that sort of sort of smart everyman thing down to a science, so he really nails it. And again, like I said, he's carrying the day, like he's there by himself, and the fact that he's able to do it and they're able to create such a compelling movie out of it, it's really just pretty impressive. So yeah, if you have a chance, Finch, pretty solid watch.
All right, from there, we're talking with Alan Adams, of course, of The Main Edge. From there, let's go to the latest from Wes Anderson, and look, I'm in the bag for anything Wes Anderson does.
I loved this movie.
Oh, good.
And I'm the same way. I'm going to be down. I'm picking up what Wes Anderson's putting down, regardless of what that might be. But it's just really, interesting to watch a movie like this, where you see someone, like, it's very much a Wes Anderson movie. There's a very distinct aesthetic, a very, thematically, just in terms of vibe, like it's all very specific to Wes Anderson, but it's also his first sort of anthology film, which it's a different animal, and so it's a different kind of Wes Anderson experience. Basically, you get more of the stuff that you love about Wes Anderson: the quirky characters, the quick hitting dialogue, like the meticulously constructed sets and screen pictures. Like, you just get a wider variety of that stuff. The basic gist is the French Dispatch of the title is a magazine. It is based in the village of Ennui, France.
I like it.
It began life as a Sunday supplement called Picnic of the Liberty, Kansas Evening Star. Before the publisher's son made his way to France and decided that this is what they were going to do, and it became a celebrated magazine, periodical publication featuring long form reportage from all manner of different types of writers. It's the New Yorker, that's the thing, and it's very clearly the New Yorker. The great thing about it is, Anderson kind of skewers it a little bit, but is also very clearly affectionate with regard to The New Yorker. I know this will shock people to hear that Wes Anderson probably likes The New Yorker, but he gets to combine that with his obvious love of France. That's where he lives now. Like, that's, so he brings these two things together, and he really does construct the movie like a magazine. And so it opens, we sort of meet some of the people who run the magazine, the printers, the cartoonists. We meet the editor, played by Arthur Howitzer Jr., played by Bill Murray, because it's a Wes Anderson movie, and you can't have a Wes Anderson movie without Bill Murray.
Nope.
We basically lead with the information that Arthur Howitzer Jr. has died, and so this issue of the French Dispatch is going to be the last one.
Ah.
And so the thing is, they're pulling from various parts of the magazine's past in order to sort of publish one last kind of best of edition. And so it's structurally, it's primarily three long form stories. The first is called The Concrete Masterpiece, which basically revolves around an imprisoned, mentally disturbed artist named Moses, played by Benicio del Toro, is discovered because one of his fellow inmates is an art dealer in on tax evasion charges, played by Adrian Brody. And so Adrian Brody discovers this artist inside prison and is like, I'm going to make this person famous. And, we're going to, and convinces his uncles, who also run the art dealership with him, that this is something they want to do. Uncles, played, by the way, by Bob Balaban and friend of downtown Henry Winkler.
Oh, that's awesome.
Meanwhile, Moses, the inmate, his muse is a woman named Simone, played by Lea Seydoux, who is, one of the prison guards. And they have we'll call it an inappropriate relationship. we'll leave it at that. So that's one, and we sort of see that dynamic play out. The second story is one, it's called Revisions to a Manifesto. And I forgot to mention, in Concrete Manifesto, the writer of the piece is played by Tilda Swinton.
Love it.
Looking less like an alien than she has in a really long time.
Oh my.
That was kind of cool. So the next one is called Revisions to a Manifesto. We have a writer named Lucinda Kremitz, played by Frances McDormand, who has become embedded in a student revolt, that's sort of a student uprising that's happening. That's being led by a young man called Zeffirelli, played by Timothy Chalamet. And it's called the Chessboard Revolution. And it's the kind of student revolution you would expect Wes Anderson to portray. We'll just leave it at that. But the two, the journalist and the young radical, wind up let's call it an inappropriate relationship. So that dynamic plays out, and we watch as... Zeffirelli is sort of trying to be the revolutionary leader that he thinks he wants, that he thinks he's supposed to be, while also receiving not insignificant editorial help from the journalist who is ostensibly supposed to be remaining neutral. So that's number two. And the last one, and I think this is my favorite, although I've sort of vacillated among them since I saw the movie. It's called The Private Dining Room of the Police Commissioner. It's sort of a story framed within a story within a story, because we're on the set of an unnamed talk show, and we have the intellectual Roebuck Wright, played by Jeffrey Wright, speaking to the unnamed talk show host, played by Liev Schreiber, about his experience. And from there, he tells a story about this legendary chef within the ranks of the police department.
Carrot cake jam is talking to me.
Looking
here
to get out. The legendary chef / police officer, Lieutenant Nescafier, played by Steve Park. Wright is invited to dine with the police commissioner, and sort of experience Nescafier's, cooking for himself. But then he winds up wrapped up in this convoluted kidnapping plot involving the son of the commissar and, you know, and the kidnapper. The kidnapping gang includes a number of incredibly familiar and famous faces that I'm not going to go into too much. And we get a chase scene that turns out to be animated for part of it. And it's one of those things where I either have to stop now or we have to just go for like 20 minutes. Meanwhile, we have a couple of other sort of bits tossed in, some moments of animation, a wonderful sort of opening piece where we have the cycling reporter played by Owen Wilson, who's basically just riding through the village of Ennui talking about, you know, what it's like. And then we close with the obituary of Arthur Howitzer Jr. And again, so it's all structured like this magazine. You know, we move back and forth visually. We have like the muted pastels, we have bright colors, we have black and white, like we have these wonderfully kinetic they're almost like live action dioramas. Like they're freeze frames, but he's not freezing the frame, it's just everybody standing really still, and so you could see little movements of the actors on screen like trying to hold still, and it's like the smoke from a gun is just like, it's clearly like cotton wadding that's been like suspended, like just all these brilliant little visual touches combined with the sort of wonderfully dense kind of dialogue that Wes Anderson is so noted for. And as we mentioned, just an incredible cast. Like he always has an incredible cast, but this one like feels like next level. Like I haven't even mentioned names like Edward Norton or Willem Dafoe or Angelica Houston or Elizabeth Moss is in this. Like just this incredible, like just, you know, and some of these people have like a couple of lines, a couple of scenes, but it's so obvious that everyone wants to work with Wes Anderson. Yeah. Like you want to be in a Wes Anderson movie, and it's just like, yeah, whatever you got, Wes, lay it on me. This was one of the best movies I've seen this year for sure. Like I absolutely loved it.
I can't wait. Finally, I'm curious to hear about this too. Chloe Zhao in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
It's weird, right?
Yeah.
It sounds weird to even say it. So Eternals. Now, I have been one to basically admit that once Guardians of the Galaxy was successful, it became clear to me that I had no concept of just how Marvel was going to work as far as all as this. Like, is it too big to fail at this point? I would argue probably yes. Like, I mean, they're going to have to take a lot. They're going to have to take a lot of big swings and have a lot of whiffs before anything, really goes south for them. Now, many of my critical brethren have been less than enthusiastic about Eternals. And I get it. I do. I'm not one of those people. Like, I really liked this movie. I understand why people might have struggled with it because basically, in the already expansive Marvel Cinematic Universe, you're basically introducing 10, 12 new characters, like an entirely new sort of aspect of the entire thing. And so, yeah, there are going to be some hiccups there. Like, that's just natural. I'll give you the gist. Back in, you know, thousands of years ago, a race of alien super beings known as Eternals are sent to Earth by one of the Celestials, being of great cosmic power, to protect the Earth from the scourge of the Deviants, which is another alien race, very vicious, sort of apex predator type collective, devoted to just basically destroying, you know, sentient life. And so the Eternals land on Earth with the intent of protecting mankind from the Deviants, but that's it. Like they're under very firm instructions not to interfere with human affairs in any other way, which is a very tidy way of sort of explaining why this is the first time we're hearing of them through all of this. They spend thousands of years cleansing the planet of the deviant threat, fighting their way through, and then come the year 1500 AD or so, they get the last one and they're like, all right, we're going to go our separate ways and wait for the call to go home. So I'm just going to read this right now because there are a lot of names and a lot of performers, and I'm definitely going to forget them if I don't look at this list. So they're led by Ajak, played by Salma Hayek, who's a healer. But all these Eternals have incredible power. There's Cersei, played by Gemma Chan. She manipulates matter. Icarus is Richard Madden. He flies, has laser eyes. Kingo, Kumail Nanjiani, sort of wields energy as a weapon. You've got Fastos, Brian Tyree Henry, who has this unsurpassed sort of mechanical genius. You've got a shapeshifter named Sprite, played by Leah McHugh. A guy named Druig, Barry Keoghan, can control minds. You've got Makari, who's super fast. That's Lauren Ridloff. Gilgamesh, Don Lee, super strong. And then last but not least, we have Thena, Angelina Jolie, who can just stab the crap out of some guys with her big, shiny spear and stuff. We're in the present day at this point. Cersei and Sprite are living together in London. She's dating a guy that she works with at the museum. But suddenly, a deviant appears. Icarus comes just in time to help them defeat it, but if there are deviants, they got to get the gang back together, find out what's going on, and that's where we'll stop as far as because once the gang starts getting back together, there's a lot of complicated stuff that starts happening, a lot of plot mechanics that unfurl, and they all spring from a pretty spoilery kind of event, so I'm just going to leave it be. Look, it's complicated. Like, you're asking a lot. You're moving back and forth in time to help sort of establish the relationship dynamics between all these characters. And again, there are a lot of characters. You have this whole sort of, you know, cosmic level of awareness happening as well. So that's a completely different level of storytelling. I don't know who could have done a better job of making this work than Chloe Zhao. I could think of a lot of people who would have made it a lot worse. but I think part of what's great about it is the fact that she has such a wonderful eye for sort of drawing out the natural beauty of her surroundings. And you wouldn't think that that would be something that a Marvel movie would rely on because, you know, it's so CGI heavy. But one of the things that she did was... whenever possible, film on location. And so we are spending a lot of time in real places. And you can tell. Like, you can tell when people are interacting with an actual environment as opposed to, you know, in front of a green screen on a soundstage. And yes, there's the CGI stuff. There's plenty of that. But the actual environments in which they're existing are real. They have that tactility. And that makes a huge difference. And... you combine that with her real gift at sort of exploring the intricacies of interpersonal dynamics, like relationships. And when you're talking about a group that has been basically together for millennia, like, those relationships matter. Those are important. Right. And those need to be brought to the forefront if we're going to have any chance of giving even the least crap about any of these people, because they're brand new. You know, and they are, as of right now, still very much separate from the larger MCU. Does it have its flaws? Yeah. Like, I mean, it's basically, like, I think the biggest issue is it's basically 10 pounds of story in a 5-pound bag. Like, it's just a lot. Like, and you're moving back and forth in time, like, in space. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, we're in Mesopotamia in 5000 BC. Oh, now we're in the Aztec Empire. Oh, and now we're, you know, during... the Spanish Inquisition, and just like moving, like having all these interactions all the while sort of bouncing back into the present day each time. Like, it can be a little confusing to maintain the timelines. That being said, I mean, I didn't have any real trouble following the action. I was delighted by some of the performances that I saw. Gemma Chan is great. Richard Madden. I was actually really kind of pleased to see Angelina Jolie in a movie like this. Like, she was clearly having a good time, and I don't remember the last time she looked like she was having a good time in a movie. And so that was really nice. And just this wonderful ensemble cast that has really come together. Oh, and I will say, I enjoyed him immensely. Kumail Nanjiani occasionally felt like maybe he was in a different movie than everybody else. not in a bad way, necessarily, but and his backstory in particular is a delight. I'm not going to spoil it, but yeah, it was a lot of fun. But Eternals. Again, I'm an MCU guy, so I was going to like this regardless, but it's better than people would have you believe.
Well, there you go. Alan Adams, four big ones for us this week on Pass the Popcorn. Thank you, Al.
My pleasure.
We'll see you Wednesday.
Yeah, you will.
Alan Adams, Main Edge. Go to the website, check out all of Alan's reviews right there on the movie review tab.